So good evening, everyone, and welcome to our class on the Parsha of the week, Parshat Korach, Korach and the Road to Hell. Korach, as we're going to see this evening, is paradigmatic of the concept of machloket, dispute, argument. And we are going to see tonight that Korach is literally the poster boy for paving the way to Gehenna, to the abyss, which is why we call it Korach and the Road to Hell. The first clue is the opening gambit, the opening verse, the pasuk, which begins our Parsha, source one. Parsha says, Vayikach Korach, and Korach took, stop. The only problem is, it mentions the assembly of his cohorts, who were with him in his potential rebellion against Moses, Aaron, and God. But it never says the object of who he took. It just says, Vayikach Korach, Korach took, and then it goes on to say, along with his assembly. But it never does tell us, so what does Rashi say? He took himself. He took himself to one side to disassociate himself from the congregation to contest the appointment of Aaron to the kahuna. He, Korach, separated himself from the congregation to persist in a machloket, a dispute. And Rashi bases this on the fact that there is no object in that first pasuk. But what's even more poignant is that Unklus, the great ger, the great righteous convert from 2,000 years ago, he uses a word which is a loaded word when describing the translation of this very first verse. He used the word palga'a, which is a dispute in Aramaic, but also connects it back to the original generation of dispute. And that was the generation of King Nimrod and the Migdal Bavel, the Tower of Babylon. And we'll come back to this perhaps later on tonight. Number two. So Korach took his minions, the tribe of Reuven essentially, and his followers, and they assembled against Moses and Aaron. They said to them, you guys take too much upon yourselves. For the entire congregation, Kulam Kedoshim, all Jews are holy. Uvisocham Hashem, and the Lord is in their midst. So why do you raise yourselves above the Lord's assembly? Are everyone's holy? Kulam Kedoshim. Number three, Rashi explains, all of the Jewish people heard the words of the commandments, the Torah at Mount Sinai, from the mouth of God. So why do you raise yourself, Moses and Aaron? If you have taken kingship for yourself, Moses, you should not have chosen the kahuna, the priesthood, for your brother. It's nepotism. Not only you heard at Sinai, I am the Lord your God, everybody, the entire congregation, heard it. Now this is the framework for the argument. Now why did this occur at this point? So the rabbis say the following, that Korach took the pulse of the people at that point. Early on, had he opened his big mouth back at Sinai, the people would have just shoved him out of the picture and thrown him out of the camp, because Moses' poll numbers were huge. They were off the charts. But in the last couple of parshas, they've taken a hit because the Jewish people have not behaved. If you recall, we had the instance of the spies, and tons of people lost their lives in the aftermath. A whole generation was sentenced to wander in the wilderness. So we've had a lot of complaints, and the response of God has not been a happy response. So each time, Moses, as the de facto king, the shepherd of the people, his numbers, his poll numbers, his popularity has gotten a little bit of a dent. So now is the opportune time, in the aftermath of last week's Parsha, which was the Meraglim, the spies. Now Korach seizes the opportunity, the initiative, to become the man of the people. And so he steps up and says, look, I don't understand. I'm a Levi. You guys are Levites. We're all Levites. So how come I'm just a generic Levite, and you, Moses, are the king, and your brother Aaron is the priest, and our younger cousin Eliezer, he runs the show as the head of the tribe of the Levites. What about me? My dad was actually from a more senior member of the family, and why am I passed over for honor? Now, it's interesting. If you look at this in our recent history of our world, it's always true. You know, the man of the people will step up, and he'll say, well, you know, everyone should be Kulam Kedoshim. We're all holy, so why are you holier than me? But, of course, at the end of the day, Korach wants to be Moses. And as we said on Shabbat, one of his original cohorts was a man named On ben Pelet from the tribe of Reuven. He was part of the original assembly, the Adat Korah. But he doesn't die because his wife says to him, mm-hmm. you're an idiot, which was a nice thing to say because she saved his life. He says, what do you mean, Aaron says? Why are you throwing your lot in against Moses with Korah? He says, because what? Think about it, dear. If Korah is right and he wins, then he becomes Moses. If he's wrong and he loses, he dies along with you. Your station won't change. Korah will become the new king, not you. You'll be the schlepper. So he thinks about it. He says, you're right. I'm an idiot. But, I gave my word. So she says, it's okay, dear. Not only do I have advice, I have a plan. Leave it to me. She cooks him a beautiful meal, serves him fine wine, gets him a little drunk, intoxicated. He goes to sleep. Gone. A couple hours later, Korach wants Aaron because they're going to go in front of the people and they're going to need full representation. And Aaron happens to be a very choshev, important member of his assembly. There's no Aaron. So he sends emissaries to go get him, bring him. Aaron's fast asleep, sleeping off his inebriation. So what happens is brilliant. Aaron's wife and his daughter step outside of the tent, Aaron's sleeping, and they sit down very publicly. And they take off their head coverings. They take off their shetel or their scarf that they're wearing. And they have long, luxurious hair. And they're both very married women. So they start combing their long hair in public. And, of course, these righteous Korach emissaries come. And they look. Oh, my gosh! Uncovered hair from a woman. I can't look, right? And they cover their eyes. And they run back home to Korach. So I always joke. I said, God forbid they should see a married woman's hair, right? But again, to rebel against God, that's not a problem. But you got to have your value system, So that apparently they were too righteous to see a married woman's hair. So they're like, oh my gosh. And they run away. By the time they come back to get Aaron, Korach and his minions are sucked into the bowels of the earth. And the event is over. Aaron lives because of his wife. And we said in Shabbat something stunning. Korach's name means shorn. Kereach means when someone takes their hair. He got his hair cut off along with every Levite as preparation for the inauguration of the tabernacle, the service. Required body hair to be removed. Apparently Korach had quite the coiffure. Beautiful hair. So he comes home after having the inauguration done, and Moses, who was a Levite himself, cut all their hair, including him, himself, all of them. She looks at him and says, you look like a buffoon. What happened to you? He says, well, I was inaugurated. They took the razor and all the hair's gone. That Moses, says the wife of Korach, he always liked your hairstyle. He was always jealous of your full head of hair. Now you look like an idiot. She incites Korach. Instead of protecting her husband, she foments his rage against Moses. She leads him to hell. The exposure of hair by the wife of Aaron saves his life. So you have the growth or exposure of hair, which could save a person, and you have the cutting off of the hair, which destroys a person. All in a parsha named for hair loss. Korach.
Where are all these stories from?
Yes, well,
Midrash. Yes, they're in the oral.
You record every single story outside every tent.
I know, but they're from the Midrash and from the Gemara. They're great stories. Is that it's mind-blowing?
Sounds like somebody had a wild imagination.
It is. Well, you know where the question comes up? The question comes up because On's name only appears in verse 1 of our parsha. Pasakal. That's it. You never hear, in other words, they detail, graphically so, the Torah says, the eventual demise and punishment given, and it singles out what happened to Datan and Aviram and Korach. Where's On? Does it say? So that's where the rabbis ask, well, what was the fate of On? How come he's not mentioned ever again after having been a very prominent member? In other words, if you look at that very first verse and mentions On's name, a revolt against Moshe and Aaron was led by a group of Levim, led by Korach and Reuvenites, led by Datan, Aviram, and On. But we don't know what happened to On. So that's like Paul Harvey's rest of the story. You got to fill in the blanks. Remember, the Torah is a framework, very concisely written. It doesn't have all the fun stuff, But all the midrashic lore, that's what they call Torah Shebaal Peh. That's the rest of the story, which is Paul Harvey, the master. Okay, let's get back into art. So our story. Korach then, as we said, purports to be a man of the people. He says, you guys are taking too much on. But as we said, you ever notice that when like the Brezhnevs of history will get up in front of their people and say, I am a man of the people. It's good when they're the man of the people because they have the dacha on the Black Sea. You don't. You're a schlepper in Moscow living in a 4x4 apartment with no heat in the winter. But everyone is generic, right? Everyone is the same. No more, no less. Money, salary, all the same. You ever notice in history, though, that there was always someone at the top of the pecking order? And they're the ones saying that you should have nothing. But nobody ever puts up their hand. Well, they do. But they don't have a good ending, right? They put up their hand and say, excuse me, Mr. Brezhnev, how come you have the big car and the yacht and the luxurious accommodations on the Black Sea? If you do that, you wind up in a place called Siberia, right? So it's not, you know, dissent is not tolerated. Now, where did this all begin? You know who the first person to ever say this was? Was Nimrod. Because King Nimrod comes along, he constructs the vision of the Tower of Babylon, and what does he say? Everyone's the same. We're all the same. We're going to build this project. We're so much the same, we're not going to use God's gift of rocks. Because rocks are different. Every single rock is not the same. We're going to manufacture identical little units called bricks. And the Torah goes out of its way to say they transform the building process of the Tower of Babylon from what had always henceforth been. Prior to that, were always God's rocks, avanim, and they became bricks. Why is that significant? Because that's what Nimrod said. Everyone's the same. We're all going to be one language, one ideal. Now, how does this connect? Because Nimrod, as we said, is the Dor HaFlaga. It is the generation of dissent, of argument. He's the first to go against God. And remember God's reaction. He comes down and sees that everything is like one language, all the same, all generic. And Hashem says, this is the end of creation. Of course, the irony is, from his attempt at the generic, what happens? 70 languages, 70 nations. Everyone spreads out to China and to Europe and everywhere. And exactly the same thing happens here. Korach attacks and tries to make everyone holy. Everything's generic. And at the end, what happens? Uniqueness. Aaron becomes unique. Jewish people become unique. So it's very, very powerful because this first verse and the nature of what Korach's trying to do has been done before by King Nimrod, not successfully then and unsuccessfully at this point in time. So he pretends then to be a man of the people. But as Mrs. On said to her husband so sagely, I don't understand. Korach just wants it for himself. He's cloaking his own jealousy and his own vision. But it's all about himself. It's not about you, Own. You're such a fool to buy into this. He's a politician. He just wants Moses' gig. He doesn't want it for you. He wants it for himself. That's all. And that was the reality. So let's go back to number 4. How bad is a dispute potentially? How destructive? So look at number 4. It says that not only did Korach die, but their wives, their children, and even their infants, the babes in arms. What? So listen to what Rashi. Rashi comments and says, come see the severity of machloket, of a dispute. The earthly courts do not punish until an accused has reached puberty. And the heavenly court, you know this from the story with Sarah, when it says she was 120 and 7, that a heavenly court up in God's realm does not punish an individual until you reach the age of 20. But here, in the story of Korach, even nursing babies were punished. They all went down with the ship, so to speak, with Korach. That's the potential of machloket. Please turn the page. Number 5 says, anyone who becomes involved in machloket, in a dispute, transgresses a negative Torah commandment. How do we know this? So the Talmud in Sanhedrin tells us that here in our parsha it says, he must not be like Korach and like his company. You cannot be involved in such a dispute. But we have a problem. Houston, we have a big problem. Jews love to argue. This is how we make our living, right? It's like the Jew, the Robinson Crusoe Jew on the island, right? He builds beautiful infrastructure, including 2 gorgeous synagogues. So they ask, but wait a minute, you're one man. Why 2 synagogues? Because this is the one I pray at, and that's the one I never go to. This is the essence of what it means to be Jewish. We, machloket, we like to have 2 Jews and 3 opinions. The problem is we're going to see, though, is that we have to somehow figure out when are we treading on Korach territory, which ostensibly is going to lead to destruction for everybody involved, as we just saw, including even infants. When is a machloket a good idea? It's good to be hurt. It's good to get up and say, no, I have a difference of opinion. In fact, it's not only good. It is the essence of life. But it's a double-edged sword because it can kill. So how do we know which one it is? Now, it is so important to have a look at number 6. Pirkei Avot, the Ethics of Our Fathers, is a unique tractate of Mishnah. It, unlike the other 62 tractates of what we call the oral framework, the Mishnah, the Torah Shebaal Peh, Pirkei Avot, which many of you may have learned, Ethics of Our Fathers, deals not really with ethics necessarily, but these sayings that define the Jewish people by all the great sages of Mishnaic times. And this is a very famous, famous Mishnah. I'll read it to you in the English, and you can follow in the Hebrew above if you like. So, any machloket, kol machloket, any dispute which is for the sake of heaven, will endure and bring life. Any machloket, any dispute which is not for the sake of heaven, will not endure and leads to death. Okay, that's pretty ominous. So what defines a machloket, a dispute that's for the sake of heaven? The machloket, the disputes that happened between the great sages Hillel and Shammai, those were for the sake of heaven. What defines a machloket, a dispute not for the sake of heaven? She'ena l'shem shamayim. Here's us right now. The machloket involving Korach and his company, Adat Korach. Pirkei Avot 5:17. Stop for a second. Now let's analyze, really analyze what we just said. So we pointed out that it is actually a biblical transgression to be like Korach and to have it to be involved in a dispute. We talked about the selfishness of Korach and his dispute, unquestioned. But if this Mishnah in Pirkei Avot, this saying is supposed to help us to understand when we're perilously close to stepping on Korach territory versus emulating the great Hillel and Shammai, it's not very useful to us. Because let's say we're involved in a dispute. How do I know? What did Korach do wrong? What did Hillel and Shammai do right? We really need to understand this. Now, let's just step back for a second and look at that Mishnah. So if you're involved in something that is for the sake of heaven, it says it'll endure. The only problem with endurance is you may not live long enough to see if you were right. In other words, if right now I'm involved in a dispute, we're at loggerheads, it's not a very helpful conclusion to say, well, you'll know if you're right if in the end it endures. But that doesn't help me at this moment. 10 years down the line, yeah, sure. In retrospect, I'll look back and say, you know what? It was a good thing that we had this dispute. But at the moment of the dispute, b'shat maisa, it's not helpful at all. So how do I know whether something's going to endure and bring life at the time that I'm involved? The engagement process is such that I can't know if it's only in retrospect. So that's not very helpful. And let's just say, okay, wait a minute. Let's talk about Hillel and Shammai. Well, Hillel and Shammai obviously talked about the realm of what? Torah observance. Korach seems to be more of a political debate, right? Well, maybe that's the difference. Maybe the Mishnah is saying that, okay, if you're involved in things that are Torah-oriented, like Hillel and Shammai, that's a good dispute. But if you're involved in political type of dispute, like Korach and his minions were, maybe that's always bad. But first of all, is that really true? And secondly, it seems to almost imply that this Mishnah is not balanced. Because if it's comparing an argument in Torah to an argument in politics only, then it doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense. There's no flip side. There's no duality, right? In other words, you can't compare a Torah dispute with a dispute in the political realm. It doesn't seem to be equal. So that can't be the simple understanding of this Mishnah. Do you hear that? In other words, it doesn't make sense to compare and contrast disparate types of arguments. That doesn't seem to be very satisfactory. And yet it's so definitive that an argument that is similar to Hillel and Shammai is kosher and good and endures and brings life. The other is the road to hell. Well, I really need to understand this then. How do we understand? Well, let's go on. Let's proceed. Number 7. Moses warned them. This means not Korach personally, Because Korach, as we spoke about in Shabbat, he wasn't really interested in saving Korach's life. He wanted Korach to be blown away by God. And the very simple answer, before you get upset at Moshe, was because we said in Shabbat the answer. If in the generation of the Torah, the legitimacy of Moses, Aaron, and then, of course, our Torah, is called into question, generations removed from Sinai and the generation of Sinai, they're going to look back and say, oh, well, you know, this Torah, oh, come on, don't take us so seriously. We can change, we can do this. After all, even Korah called into question the nature of the Torah. Maybe there was nepotism involved in the appointments of Moses and Aaron. It's all about them. So if that was allowed to stand, Moses realized Torah will not endure. So he asked for Korah's destruction. Okay. But what is the hint then that Moses was telling the Adat Korach, the people accompanying him, his assembly, that you better watch out who you're throwing your cards in? Because have a look. Look what he said. Moses warned them. The man that God chooses as the Kohen Gadol, as his high priest, he is the one sanctified. Is that not rather obvious? Obviously, the one God chooses is holy. No. Moses was saying something much different. But Moses was telling them, you are 250 men here. He warned the Adat Korach, the congregation, the assembly of Korach. The one who is chosen, he and he alone will be the one to walk away alive. The rest of you are all dead.
Yeah.
Right. Korach was a smart fellow. How did he agree to such a lunatic trial? Stop for a second. Keep your finger there. If I had 250 numbers, and unless you get lucky number one, and you draw one of the other numbers, 2 to 249, essentially you're going to face a firing squad, who would take those odds? One in 250, I have a chance of actually living, but everyone else is dead? They're not good odds. Aha, Korach had inside information. He's the guy at the racetrack who knows the race is fixed. Well, how is the race fixed? I'm glad you asked. Have a look at Rashi says. His vision of the future, of Korach's future, fooled him. Korach saw through somehow he had like a almost precognitive neviut, prophecy. He saw that great people would descend from him, like Shmuel, like the great prophet Samuel, who was as great as Moses and Aaron. So Korach agreed to the plan, assuming that the others would all be killed, but one would be chosen, himself. Oh, my gosh. What does this tell you about Korach? Now, let's step back for a second. Let's say Korach really was the man of the people that he professed to be. Everyone's holy. Moses, Aaron, why do you take all the glory? Everyone should have a shot. Everyone should have like a rotating priesthood and a rotating Levite class. Everyone gets a chance to wear the colors, right? Everyone plays for the Yankees. It's not fair that I have to play for the Milwaukee Brewers. We all want to play for the Yankees. But I want you to think of how cold he was. He saw, unfortunately for himself, not clearly enough, that Samuel the prophet would be his great-grandson. So he thought, well, if Samuel's my great-grandson, I live another day. I'll get through this. Oh my gosh, great. Fantastic. Moses says, one man will be chosen in the test of the incense. How did it work? He challenged them. You guys all want to be the Kohen? You say Aaron's not the real guy? Okay, get the ketoret, get the incense, bring it in to the Holy of Holies, but realize that laser beams will blow away anyone who is not chosen by God, and one man will be not laser beamed to death. So Korach says, oh, okay, I'm in. So all the other 250 are with them. They're going like, okay, we're in. Now, they're absolutely out of their minds, right? Because the odds aren't very good. And Moses laid it right out there for him. But Korach.
Not only that, the other people are really stupid because if they even believe Korach, they shouldn't go there.
Right.
Based on the percentage.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. It's lunacy. It shows you. Phil, thank you. The power. Power of jealousy. The Reuvenites were the firstborn of the Jewish people. They were the eldest son of Jacob. They were stripped of the rights to serve God because Reuven took the couch that Jacob used to use, and it was always in Rachel's tent. And after Rachel's death, without permission, he takes that special lazy boy recliner and puts it into his mom Leah's tent because it was at Bilhah's tent. It was one of the maidservants. And Reuven says, wait a minute. I will not accept this indignity to my mother Leah. It was bad enough that Rachel got first dibs on the love of my father. As long as Rachel was alive, I accept this. But now that Rachel's dead, my mom Leah's going to be chopped liver to a maidservant Bilhah. So he went in to protect his mom's dignity, ostensibly, takes the couch that Jacob used to communicate with God on and moves it into his mom Leah's tent to show Leah's the primary mother now that Rachel's dead. And God says, no, you don't do such actions, Reuven. And he was stripped of his rights to be the Bachor. Beforehand, there were the Levites and the Kohanim were never going to be the chosen of God. It was going to be given to the firstborn. So that is the rage within the tribe of Reuven that was fomented by Mr. Korach. He said, look at you guys. It's all about Moses and Aaron. You guys should have been doing it all. Now, he never says to them the following statement. By the way, guys, before you accept the challenge, I want to give you a little inside information. Samuel the prophet, I know you don't know who he is, but a couple books he's going to write, including the Book of Ruth, and he's a big guy. He's yet to be born, but he will be born from me. So that means I, Korach, I alone will survive the test. You may want to think and rethink your participation in the lunatic trial of the 250 bringing the incense. Now, if it was just Korach versus Aaron, fair one-on-one, right? A little one-on-one basketball, that's okay. But can you imagine the calculated coldness of Korach, the evil, to allow his friends to go in, throw in their lot with him, and he doesn't even say to them, guys, I already know that American Pharaoh is going to win the race, so you better not bet on any of the other horses, because you're going to lose your money, your life. No, doesn't tell them anything. Now, at the point where he says, caveat emptor, I will walk out according to God's vision that I have, then if they choose to throw their lot in, okay, go Kassandra Hay, right? I mean, they're lunatics, okay? But he didn't even tell them. So here's the man of the people who's willing to sacrifice the lives of the 250 friends, quote unquote, that he has, his posse. Not a nice man, right? But isn't that exactly what every little dictator over history, you know, the famous evil Mao Zedong, wicked Russia Marisha. Okay, anyone, by the way, who ever tries to say to you there was one good thing about him is full of baloney. Okay, the man was as bad as Stalin and Hitler in his own way. They don't even know the millions that he killed. They're only guessing because of the nature, the secretive nature of the Chinese culture. He was quoted as saying the following. I'm just paraphrasing. Somebody said, Chairman Mao, if you follow through on your vision for a new China, up to 100 million of your citizens could lose their lives. You know what his response was? Mm-hmm. Basically, I'm paraphrasing, if it takes 100 million, but the greater good will be accomplished. If it takes 250 of my pals from Reuven to go down and be burned up by God, okay, but I'll have made my point against Moses and Aaron, and I'm going to walk away with the glory. It's exactly the same issue. Yeah. Exactly the same issue. It's stunning how history just, you know, repeats and repeats. Okay, let's go back inside. So we now have insight into Korach, the man of the people willing to throw his people under the bus. Okay? Now, how bad is the potentiality of the destructive power of Machloket? You want to see how bad it is? Have a look at number 8. This is stunning. Because we need to find out whether we're going to be like Hillel and Shammai and create a world, or we're going to be, God forbid, like Korach and destroy a world. So why does it not say, the Midrash, the oral tradition, ask the following questions? Does not say it was good, vayihi tov. It says tov by every day of creation. It even says tov me'od, very good, at the end of the creation process. But there's one day where there's no word tov. You know, guess what day that was? Day 2. So the question is, why does it not say it was good on the second day of creation? Because machloket, dispute, was created on that day. As it says, it shall divide between waters and waters. This is in Genesis 1:6. Now imagine, If machloket, that means dispute or here separation, which exists from God only for the development and building of the world, is deficient in it was good, means you can't call it good. How much more deficient is a machloket, a dispute, which exists for the hurt and turmoil of the world? So in other words, we're talking that during the Genesis project, God says he separated right from the waters above the firmament, me'al l'rakia, mitachat l'rakia, from underneath the firmament. But in that separation, which is necessary to create planet Earth, somehow there's something deficient, something lacking. And God can't use the word tov. I can't call it good, because from the separation, that's what dispute is, separation. But the potential for destruction came from that moment. How do we know this? Have a look at number 9. It shall divide, mavdil, between waters and waters. Here is where machloket arose, dispute. And from machloket, from dispute, came the fire of animosity. And from machloket, and here's where we get our title of our class tonight, came hell itself. Such was the machloket, the dispute of Korach, not for the sake of heaven. However, but machloket that becomes, and it refines, as above, machloket which reaches higher and ever higher, enduring along a wholesome path, such was the machloket, the dispute, oh my gosh, we're right back to that mission in Pirkei Avot, of Shammai and Hillel. And God divided between them and acknowledged them both. This is machloket for the sake of heaven, that God says both are good. Stop for a second. So let's now reiterate our question. We really need to understand, what was it about Korach that was a dispute not for the sake of heaven? Now we know now, in retrospect, we're like Monday morning quarterbacks. We know that he had inside information. He was willing to throw his teammates under the bus. Yes. We know what an evil character he was in the heart. Mm-hmm. Right? The shadow in us, we all know what lurked in his evil heart. But if he is paradigmatic, don't emulate his behavior. The Bible says, don't be like him. Then if I'm arguing with you about anything, how do I know if I am treading into Korach territory or I am closer to Hillel and Shammai? Is it anything political is bad? Well, that can't be true. Is it anything in the Torah is always good? Well, I don't think so. Because Korach cloaked his argument in Torah law. Remember, he came in to Moses, you ready for this? And they're wearing purple, tehillah, perfect, beautiful outfits. Now, normally, one strand of this little purple-blue shellfish dye comes from a little crustacean. One little petil, one little corner of your garment, of the tzitzit, makes the entire tzitzit kosher. They wore entire purple garments, and they walked in. They said, Moses, we have a question. I said, yes. Well, do these garments that are all made out of tehillah, do they still have to have tzitzit on the fringes on them? Moses said, yeah. And then they walked away. They didn't respond. Then they went outside, and Korach said, do you see what an idiot Moshe is? He's making this all up. Guys, think about it. If a strand of this color exempts the whole garment, then surely if the whole garment is that color, you don't need the strands at all. It's ridiculous. And then they came back for a second question. Excuse me, Moshe? We have a question. Does a house that is filled with Torahs from top to bottom still require a mezuzah on the doorpost? He said, yes. They walked outside, and Korach turned. He said, I told you he's an idiot. He's making this up. It's not God. They said, what do you mean? Well, clearly, if two tiny sections of the Shema are in a mezuzah, and we have a house full of Torahs, why do we need a mezuzah on the doorpost? Obviously, every Torah contains those parchments, and the house is inherently protected. We don't need it. This is a joke. So in other words, they even cloaked their dispute in the realm of Torah disputation. So it doesn't help us to say, well, one's political, one's Torah, because as I just showed you, Korach's dispute entered into the realm of Torah, ostensibly. Of course, it was all about himself. So let's get to the bottom of it. Number 10. We said in our Mishnah, in quote number 6, I'll repeat it, any dispute which is L'shem Shemayim, for the sake of heaven, will endure and bring life. Any dispute which is not for the sake of heaven will not endure and leads to death. What defines a machloket, a dispute for the sake of heaven? A dispute between Hillel and Shammai. What defines a machloket that is not for the sake of heaven? A dispute involving Korach and his company. Let's get back now to number 10. So why did Beit Hillel, the house of Hillel, his family, why did they merit that the halacha, the Jewish law, should in almost every instance follow them? Because they were accepting and tolerant and would always repeat both their own opinion and the opinion of Beit Shammai. Not only that, they would quote the opinion of Beit Shammai before mentioning their own. So you go to someone from Rabbi Hillel, Hillel's house, you say, okay, kosher, non-kosher. So someone from Beit Hillel would say, well, before I answer your question for you, according to the great Beit Shammai, according to the house of Shammai, they would tell you X, Y, Z. I feel X, Y, Z. Now, it's nice, it's beautiful, it's honorable. But how in the world is that helpful? Because it doesn't mean he's right. And in fact, the people from Beit Shammai were sometimes even smarter than the people from Beit Hillel, a little sharper maybe. So because you're a nice guy is not a good enough reason to follow Jewish law. I want to know that I'm right in the Jewish law. I want to go to the sharpest rabbi I can find, not the nicest rabbi. It's nice that he's a nice guy, but I want someone who's not only a nice person, I want the guy who knows the truth. So that's not necessarily satisfactory. Please turn the page. This following story is going to, number 12, is going to tell us really the crux of tonight's question. Answer, I think, will answer hopefully all of our questions and give clarity to everything we discussed. There were two great rabbis in the Gemara. One was named Rabbi Yochanan, and one was named Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. Now, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish, to give you a little backstory, had been a highway robber of infamy. He was like the Jesse James of Israel. But Rabbi Yochanan made him become religious. He saw within him tremendous brain power, tremendous strength. And not only did he allow him to become a student of his, he allowed him to marry his sister, and they became learning partners, chavrutas. And Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish was like a brilliant genius. They call him Reish Lakish as like an acronym, Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish. He and Rabbi Yochanan are everywhere. When you open a Talmud, Reish Lakish, Rabbi Yochanan, they argue, and they have disputes all the time. And they got in very heated disputes. But again, their dispute was the Hillel Shammai dispute, which according to what we said in Pirkei Avot, Ethics for Fathers, that builds worlds and endures and brings life to the world. But there was a sad end. Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish died. So let's read this. Reish Lakish, the Talmud and Bava Metzia tells us, died. And Rabbi Yochanan ached for him painfully. So the rabbis came up with a plan, said the sages, who loved Rabbi Yochanan. They said, who can we send to him, to Rabbi Yochanan, to take Reish Lakish's place as his learning partner and bring him some comfort? He's just going out of his mind. Let's send Rabbi Elazar ben Pedat, who is brilliantly knowledgeable. Rabbi Elazar was like the highest IQ rabbi they knew, other than Rabbi Yochanan or Rabbi Reish Lakish. So Rabbi Elazar went, and he sat before Rabbi Yochanan, and they learned. Everything that Rabbi Yochanan said, he said, I believe this is a law. Rabbi Elazar would respond with a source to prove Rabbi Yochanan was right. And it went on after a couple of hours. Cried Rabbi Yochanan, you are supposed to be like Reish Lakish, Rabbi Elazar. Why, when Reish Lakish would respond to something I said, he would respond with 24 objections and challenges to what I said. And then I would have to respond with 24 counters to his 24 challenges. And the concept would keep getting broader and broader and expanding. All you can come up with is, I can prove your contention that you're right. What am I, an idiot? You don't think I know myself what is right about what I'm saying? I want to know what's wrong about what I'm saying. Rabbi Yochanan was inconsolable. He began wandering about, tearing his clothing and crying. He used to say, where are you, Reish Lakish? Where are you? He would scream until he went insane. And the rabbis prayed for mercy. Rabbi Yochanan died. Now, It's hard to say that story because it's very personal. It's a very tough story. But this is so magnificent. Listen to what Rabbi Yochanan was saying, and listen to why Hillel and Shammai are the best. Rabbi Yochanan was saying, look, we disagreed. We fought. We had blood on the floor in the Beis Medrash between Rish Lakish and I. I threw something out at him. He didn't just say, yes, you're right, like you, Rabbi Lazar. He took 24 different approaches and blew me away. Then I had to defend my position with 24 others, and we expanded our learning, and it just became godlike. When I say something and you say dittos, I know what I said is right. That's why I said it. I want to know why I'm wrong. So in other words, Rabbi Yochanan is saying, without Rish Lakish, there cannot be Rabbi Yochanan. Because his position, refines and defines my position. When Hillel says to somebody, oh, before I tell you what I believe, you need to know what Shammai believes. He wasn't being a nice guy. I mean, he was. But listen to what he was saying. Unless I have Shammai's contrary position to mine, I don't know where my position is. My truth is only a truth because there is a machloket, a dispute, and it is refined and defined by the preciousness of Shammai. In other words, yes, we don't get along when it comes to Torah law. We fight, we argue. But the argument is not about me. It's about an ultimate truth, God's truth. So I can't be me, Hillel is saying, essentially, without Shammai existing. Rabbi Yochanan says, I need Reish Lakish. There is no Rabbi Yochanan without Reish Lakish. Ah, let's get back to our statement. If you argue, but you respect the person that you're arguing with, more than that, you understand that without your feedback, my opinion doesn't really matter. In other words, when I throw something out as a truth and you blow it out of the water, then I have to defend my truth. And then we get going. But at the end of the day, what emanates is absolute truth from God, because it's refined and defined. So when the Mishnah said, what is the paradigmatic example of when you're involved in a dispute, that it's a holy dispute? If you not only value the other person, but you understand that without the other person's opinion, your opinion doesn't exist, then you're in a dispute for the sake of heaven. But if your opinion's all about what you can get out of it, and when somebody's contrary, you take it offensively, that's Korach! And what's the proof? You want to hear the most delicious proof of all? It's amazing. In the Mishnah, it said, how do you know your dispute is Hillel and Shammai? Because it's like Hillel and Shammai. What should it have said when showing us the duality, the opposite? If you want to know what's the road to hell, it's Korach and his dispute with Moses and Aaron. But it doesn't say that, does it? It says Korach and his assembly. That's the bad dispute. But wait a minute. Korach didn't have a dispute with his assembly. His dispute was with Moses and Aaron. But that's not true anymore. Because we proved tonight that he's willing to throw even his own assembly under the bus. Everyone, tribe of Reuven, Edward G. Robinson, Datan, Aviram, they were only in it for themselves. So they weren't in it for the other guy. So therefore, when the Mishnah says the dispute was between Korach and his assembly, they weren't on the same team. Korach wasn't a team player. Datan and Aviram weren't team players. None of them. So therefore, it was all about myself, not about you. Do I care about your opinion? Not in the least. Do I need you to define and refine my opinion? What do I need you? You're an idiot. That is the road to hell. That is the destruction. When you not only not have any value for the other opinion, you're not even acknowledging the other person is relevant to your whole world. That was Korach. You die, you can bring the incense. One man will live, Korach. Oh, okay, that's okay. I don't mind if my 250 teammates die and get burned up, because I'm going to live. I have inside information. That's why it never said the dispute was between Korach and Moses. And by the way, the ultimate irony is, Korach never engaged Moses in a direct dispute. Yes, he asked him the questions about the Tehillah, and he asked about the house full of Torahs, whether it requires a mezuzah. He never argued with Moses. You know why? Because he would lose. And to engage the argument meant Hillel and Shammai type of engagement. He wasn't interested in engagement. He's interested in simply rhetoric. So it was all about himself, self-promotion, self-aggrandizement. And by the way, who picked up on this instantly? The women, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. The wife of Om Ven-Pelas instantly picks up, and she's sensitive and says, my dear, it's all about Korach. Why are you part of this? Are you insane? So I believe at the end of the day, Machloket is holy. It's fantastic. You need multiple opinions, because if I don't have your feedback, then I'm a buffoon, because my opinion will stand and I don't have anyone to poke holes in it. Even great lawyers will tell you before they go to trial, they will present their case in front of others. They'll even get a mock jury and a mock, if it's a big enough trial, and they weed out all the insanity and weak positions of their arguments. Why? Because they want to refine and define what they have to say, what is truth and what is garbage. That's what we do with Torah. We get involved in the Torah study and we get really hot. I remember guys in yeshiva would literally get up out of their seats and would be yelling at the guy 3 feet away from you. Yo, hear me, I've been explaining it 18 different ways. This is what Rashi's saying. And another guy would be like, no, this is what Tosfos, right? And you would think they're going to come to blows. And yet, at the end of the day, they loved each other. The way Shammai and Hillel, they may have argued, they got down and dirty in the realm of Torah, but you know what they say? At the end of the day, never did Hillel or Shammai ever not engage socially. Their children married. They eat each other's food. Why? Sometimes Hillel and Shammai had divergent opinions about kosher or not kosher, because Hillel and Shammai had such respect for each other that they knew, if I'm going to eat at someone's house, he's going to respect my dietary laws and the way I view things. And if he's going to marry his daughter to my son, I know that whatever issues he has with Jewish law and who is a Jew, whatever, that won't be an issue. He would never allow it to be an issue because we have respect. So at the end of the day, I think the mission is telling us, if you value the other opinion, but more than that, if you understand that without the other opinion, your opinion can't stand. That is a machlokas, l'shem shemayim, that's a dispute for the sake of heaven. God willing, we will continue to have our disputes to continue to create worlds.